Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to this episode of Roller Out the Barrel, the vintage baseball podcast that generally talks to vintage baseball players. Although with us all at home, with our stay-at-home orders, I've changed content a little bit more so I can get more out there for you. So we can still talk about the glorious game of baseball and be safe as we are doing it, as you cannot play baseball 6 feet apart from each other. That would be bad. On the phone today, we are doing something way different and way cool, and I can't wait to get into this. But on the phone from Oregon is Daniel Jones. Daniel, how you doing?
I'm great, Matthew. Thanks for having me.
Oh, absolutely. This is a fascinating talk we're about to have that's going to interest a lot of people. And we're going to get right into why we're having this talk right off the bat. You, as a lover of baseball, you came across 19th century town ball, the Massachusetts version, and you have taken that and you have taken it step by step up to where you think it would be if that was the sport that actually took off instead of baseball. And you have gone with what you think the rules would be and everything, and you currently exist in that fashion. So I want you to start with when you first came across town ball and the evolution of where you are today.
Yeah, I can do that. Again, thanks for having me on the show. I appreciate it. This is exciting for us, and I say us because there's actually quite a few people supporting me in this and have been wanting me to do something like this for some time, to reach out and to share our game. We've come across a game that we call 21st Century Town Ball. And I say we, the bulk of my supporters are actually students of mine. When I was a teacher at University High School over in Fresno, California, I was there for 15 years. So if we have a little bit of time, I can maybe just kind of give some backdrop and then, you know, maybe tell more about the game. But
you can go ahead and talk about anything in any way you want.
Great. So my name is Daniel Jones. I was born in Wisconsin. My parents are from Wisconsin and Minnesota, that area. That's where my roots are. When I was 5 years old, my parents moved to Taiwan and were missionaries there for 20 years. And while I was there, I played baseball. I played baseball just like probably most of your listeners all my life. Baseball was big in Taiwan. Baseball was big in Minnesota, where I would go back in the summers. It's all I did, play baseball. It's all I thought about.
So would you say that your love for baseball was made in Taiwan?
It was. It was made in Taiwan. My dad took me to a high school baseball game between, I think it was an American school and a Taiwanese school or something like that. I can't remember the details. I was only 8 years old at the time. And he got really excited about it. He's like, oh, they have baseball here. Let's get my son into baseball. And he loved baseball. And so it kind of started when I was 8 years old. I wasn't that young when I started.
Were you going to professional games in Taiwan?
Yes. They have a professional league. It's really fun because they only have three teams. Professional baseball with three teams is awesome.
And the atmosphere at a baseball game, and I don't know about this, and you're about to teach me something. Am I correct that the atmosphere at a baseball game is completely different as far as the fans go, how they're much louder and much more into the game?
Exactly. They're much louder and much more into the game. They the whole time they're cheering, the whole game. Chanting and cheering, lots of beer, a lot of fun. Baseball is big there, it is in Japan.
But the flow of the game is much like the American version, correct? So it's not a fast-paced, energetic game that they're watching, but yet they're keeping up their emotion the entire game.
Yeah, honestly. Just jump in some of the things I was going to talk about anyway. I think Taiwan is still in that pre-steroid mode, where it's just like back in the 1910, 1920, 1930s, Baseball is like that here in the United States. That's how it is there in Taiwan.
Oh, okay. But, yeah, I would
They did love the game. It's very innocent. And, yeah, it's more of a newish thing, kind of like it was here for a long time.
So when you come back from Taiwan, or you come to the United States and you go to a Major League Baseball game for the first time, that's got to blow your mind, right?
It did. I'm actually a big Twins fan. So my first professional baseball game was actually I went to Wrigley Field when I was really small, but it was a Twins game back when they were really good in the 87-91 era. So, yeah. It's a much bigger experience in the United States, that's for sure.
And the Twins fans back in the 80s, late 80s and early 90s, they were actually a really good fan base. So,
yeah.
And the fans acted a little bit different back then, too, you know, 30 years ago.
They did. So, they did. And my grandmother watched all the Twins games on TV. So it's kind of like a family thing for us to watch baseball, play baseball, like probably like a lot of your listeners.
Right. So when you come back from Taiwan, where does your love of baseball take you on this journey?
My whole thing growing up, I wanted to play baseball. My dream was to start with college baseball and see where I could go from there. I moved to Minnesota after high school. I played varsity soccer my freshman year, and I was planning on playing baseball too, but I ended up breaking my finger right before tryouts for baseball. And when something like that happens, it gets you thinking. So I kind of started rethinking my priorities. I was already experiencing some culture shock from being back in the Midwest, big difference from Taiwan. So I never ended up playing college baseball. I ended up dropping out of college, went back to Taiwan to kind of start over at that time. Although I did start a cricket club at the college where I was attending. I started thinking about the game itself with baseball, and I don't want to step on your toes here, but I was like, you know, there's something missing in baseball. It could be a lot more fun. I'm kind of an explorer, like a creative type person.
Sure.
And I went into cricket, and I said, well, this game has something that baseball doesn't. I love the fact that there's no foul balls in cricket. I love the fact that you can steal, the batter can steal first, so to speak, because you can run back and forth. So if the bowler's not paying attention, the runners can just take off. It's kind of a more lively game that way, that you always have to be aware. The ball's always in play, unlike in baseball where there's a lot of downtime. So I kind of got into cricket for a while.
So the concept of baseball, you love that, but you're looking for something a little more energetic, and you didn't go over to football like most of the country does when they're looking for more excitement. You wanted to take the premise of something you fell in love with, and you just wanted to see if you could change it up a little bit, or at least find that they changed it up a little bit, or whatever you could do to maybe get your attention more on it, maybe?
Yeah, that kind of thing. But for a while, I was just like, okay, yeah, baseball's great. I love baseball. I continue to play baseball, but cricket was more scratching the itch for me. It's just got something that baseball doesn't. But after a while, there's something about baseball that cricket doesn't have, and that's the base running of baseball. You just can't beat that. And after a while, I started to, like, I miss the base running. I miss the sliding. I miss the, you know, stolen base, hit-and-run play. So I guess fast forward a little bit, I ended up moving to California, finally got my math degree, and was teaching math, and I started a cricket club, a very successful intramural program we had for cricket for a couple years. My direct supervisor, Steve Guile, he said to me one day, hey, you know, you got a really successful program for cricket in the spring. I think you can come up with something for the fall. I was like, I'll see what I can do. So I taught a class that winter. It was an elective class. We met 3 hours a day for 2 weeks. The title of the class was The Origins of American Pastime. And we basically researched 10 different bat and ball games that were played either in our history or batting ball games that are played around the world. We looked at Finnish baseball. We looked at some other kind of obscure versions of baseball. Can't remember the name of them, but like you're running across a football field back and forth, trying not to get pegged, but still a version of baseball. And on the second day of the class, one of my students, his name, Edison Giles, his responsibility was to look up the Massachusetts game. Because there were 10 different bat and ball games, we had 20 students. That pair brought in the Massachusetts game. So we played the Massachusetts game on the second day of class. And oh my goodness, it was one of the best experiences I had playing ball in a long time. And everybody agreed. All the kids were just like, this game's amazing. So after that, we kept trying different bat and ball games, all the different ones we were researching. But no matter what game we played, we kept saying after about 20 minutes, you know what, let's go back to the Massachusetts game. So we ended up playing the Massachusetts game every single day. We just fell in love with the game. It's an amazing game. I don't know if your listeners are familiar with it. They probably are. It's a lot of fun, the Massachusetts game.
Can you go over some, you know, I don't expect you to cover it from start to finish, but can you give us some idea of what the rules were of the Massachusetts game?
I can. Do you know who John Thorne is? He's the official historian of Major League Baseball. Have you heard of him?
Yes, sir.
So he has written a book called, which your listeners probably know about, Baseball in the Garden of Eden. He talks about the Massachusetts game. He's quoted in there and in a couple of interviews elsewhere of saying that he has no idea how the New York game went out over the Massachusetts game as American pastime. So, as you know, the New York game is what is baseball. It's what we play with the diamond. And the things that he quotes about the game that he loves the fact that there's no baseline. I mean, he says you can run, take the fielders out into a merry chase into the outfield and beyond. And if you think about it, why do we have the concept of a baseline in baseball? I think I know why. Because you're afraid that if you have to chase a runner, somebody else can advance. And so in the Massachusetts game, that idea is embraced. Where, yeah, if you can get someone to follow you out in the outfield, you can get the other runners to score.
Sure.
So there's no baseline in the Massachusetts game. And that's one of the best parts of the game. There's about 10 things that I've identified that make this game just phenomenal. And that's the one that John Thorne mentions. That and you can peg the base runners, which was a rule in most versions of baseball. Earlier in the 19th century, but the Massachusetts game never gave that one up.
So you're playing the Massachusetts style. How long before you start wanting to put your own spin on it?
It didn't take long. We were having so much fun, and we said to ourselves, "Okay, this is the game we're looking for. We want to play this in the fall. We've got cricket in the spring." Let's play this in the fall. But we realized that the game as it was, if you look at vintage baseball and most of the rules, like even though there's a shorter list of rules, you can still play the game. The Massachusetts game, however, the rules are so short, I think there's 21 of them, and not very like detailed and clear that there's parts about the game that are just not playable. And also another thing about baseball, if you think about baseball played in the 19th century and how it's played now, obviously it's not the same game. It's evolved over time. And people have filled in rules where they thought rules were missing. And so the Massachusetts game likewise had things that were missing, but the game didn't have the same opportunity to develop over time the way the New York game did. So it kind of just like stopped almost like in its infancy before it became like a full game. Maybe some people in the Massachusetts area might disagree with me, but that's how we saw it. A couple of things we noticed: that distance is only 35 feet away, and where has that worked for our high school group, especially in a class where people can't necessarily throw that hard? Once we started playing it more like rigorously, it became very difficult to hit 35 feet away throwing fastball, right? Mm-hmm. So that was one aspect. Another aspect that was kind of missing was that there's actually no built-in incentive for the batter to swing. In baseball, you have the idea of strikeouts and walks, where, you know, if you throw a ball right down the middle in modern baseball, it's a strike. You only get three of those. In the early form of the Massachusetts game, you could be throwing fastballs down the middle all day, and the batter technically didn't have any incentive to have to swing. And so we developed some rules to change that. The base pass, quite a few things we changed to keep the same flavor of the Massachusetts game, but it's playable in the modern setting.
So when you're changing these rules and you're putting your own spin on it, you're not just making up new rules for kicks. You're actually putting thought into these as to where would this have evolved to today. Am I right?
That's right. Not only have we did we put thought into where would it have evolved, we made sure that we could find a precedent for every rule that we came up with in some form of early baseball. For example, if you look at the pitching, the idea of the incentive to swing, what we did is we built the zone. Right, it looks a lot like a wiffle ball zone for those who play wiffle ball. So the precedent for that comes from the stool ball, which was played by milkmaids that took a stool, and the pitcher was to hit that stool to get the batter out. And they still play stool ball in some places. So we borrowed from that idea, but cricket also has the same idea of the wickets, right? So if you're pitching the ball, you hit those wickets, the batter's out. So it's not like we just kind of made things up, like you said. We definitely said, okay, you know, is there a precedent for these various rules? And most of the rules that we found are straight from the Massachusetts game, except for ones that have to be borrowed in order to make this a playable game.
Right. So you're taking this very seriously. You are not just whimsically doing whatever you want. You want to make sure you're crossing your T's and dotting your I's and paying respect to something that you really don't know what the finished product is, but you really are caring about it. So
yeah, absolutely. And that and we've been doing this now since 2012. It's hard to know exactly how to reach out. You know, we tell our friends about it, people come play, and they love it. Like, wow, why is this not a national game? This is amazing. This should be an international game. This should be an Olympic game. Like, this is so fun. Why is this not known? And I've been trying to reach out to the vintage baseball community here on the West Coast with limited success, partly because, you know, we're all so busy. But part of it, things in the West Coast regarding baseball, it's just a little dry. It's a little hard to get things going. You had your interview with Blackjack, you know, a few weeks back, and he said the same thing. This isn't baseball mecca. You know, that's over where you guys are at. And so we have the advantage of saying, okay, let's kind of break out of the mold and let's try something further back. Because if you look at the history of baseball, now, of course, some people are going to say, like, oh, you're playing a modern game. That's not vintage baseball. And I don't agree with that statement at all. And the reason is, if you look the furthest back you can go, right? Because how far back do you have to go to vintage baseball? If you go back further than the 19th century, right, you get all these different variations of bat and ball. The furthest back you can go, I think there's a quote from Jane Austen in her novel Northanger Abbey. And she actually flat out says that, you know, this is a time of invention, and the areas in which invention is greatest is in the area of baseball. So if you really want to talk about vintage baseball, in the 19th century and before that, the whole idea was coming up with new rules and see what you come up with to make it work. In my opinion, the whole idea about going back and strictly playing according to certain rules, because from a certain time period, yes, that's vintage from one perspective, but it's not vintage according to that time, because in their time, they were always tweaking the rules to try and make the best game they could make. So from that standpoint, I think our game is at least as vintage as any other version.
All right, and this subject right here is where I'm going to start getting letters. Because we always say in vintage baseball, in fact, it's a motto of a lot of teams, is playing baseball the way it was meant to be. And I totally disagree with that statement. We have something that they did not, and we have hindsight. I'm always right. They changed rules so often that they were not happy with the rules they had. That's why they kept changing them. So when you say we're going to play 1864 vintage baseball rules, playing baseball the way it was meant to be, no, that's not how it was meant to be. They wanted to evolve the game all the time, and you're saying the same thing, and not in just the baseball, but the other bat and ball games, is you want to evolve it to get it to a point where it is the way it's meant to be.
Yeah, precisely. And, you know, that whole, but there's another quote, you know, playing ball when it was just a game. And I love that quote, because that's kind of how baseball was. It just, you know, there's all those quotes from Tom Hanks, for example. Baseball is what gets inside of you. It lights you up. I totally agree with that. Like, baseball gets inside of me. It just drives me crazy. I love baseball, right? But the thing is, the whole quote about playing ball when it was just a game, that can happen now. And our quote regarding town ball is, let's play town ball when it is just a game. So that's kind of the way we play it. Let's play now. Play a vintage-style ball game that works for today.
So give me some examples of rules that existed for the Massachusetts game that you tweaked to make it more palatable, I guess, for today.
Sure, I'll do my best. Let me start by saying we do have a website called 21st Century Town Ball. It's 21ctownball.com. And it does have we have a lot of history written in there to show the legitimacy of what we're doing, et cetera. I'll let readers read about it. But, so let's see, where should I start? In Massachusetts game, what were some of the rules? They had no foul balls, first of all. Maybe we should talk about the pitching. So, you know, in vintage baseball, people know this, that the New York game, right now, modern baseball is a fast pitch game. The thing about the field, it's not really designed to be a fast pitch game. So I make the case that modern baseball is inherently flawed because it was meant to be played slow pitch. That's the way the game was, the original rules, and that's why there was a foul territory, right? Because it's modern baseball, very few balls are actually put in play. People have timed the amount of time that the ball is actually in play in a Major League Baseball game for 3 hours comes down to minutes.
Right.
That's kind of where a lot of the sentiment in our country comes from. Oh, baseball is boring. And I think they have a point. The game itself is not boring. I mean, who doesn't like to hit a ball, chase a ball, pitch a ball? It's amazing. But the thing is, the way that the game is developed as a fast pitch game doesn't quite work. On the contrary, in contrast, the Massachusetts game was always a fast pitch game. It was always meant to be a fast pitch game. There's no foul ball. So it's awesome. It's just like cricket that way. You pitch a ball, it's ticked, you know, backwards. It's in play. There's people scrambling to get it. People are running. The ball's always in play. In cricket, you can steal first, right? So even when the pitcher doesn't pitch it, you can take first. That was not one of the original rules in Massachusetts game, but we did borrow that one from cricket. We said the batter can run to first. So we can steal first, even if you don't hit the ball. And we found it to be necessary. Our bases are pretty far apart. Massachusetts game, you got 30 feet, 60 feet, 60 feet, 60 feet score run. Not many feet. In 21st Century Town Ball, I think it's 140 feet. I think totally, no more than that. It's 42 feet to first, 68 to second, then 110 to third, 110 to fourth, and then 110 to fifth. You have to run a long way to score a run.
Yes.
So in the original – yeah, go ahead.
I don't know if I can – I would have to start training to play that.
It's amazing. It's like when you score a run, after running that far, you feel so accomplished.
So that, right, yeah. There, the stake, the distance between the stakes are That is similar, and I'm actually reading on the on a website right now, protoball.org. Sure. That is your site as well?
Which one?
Protoball.
Okay, Protoball was put together by Larry McKay and his crew. I don't know if you know that site, but let me tell you readers right now, if you haven't looked at Protoball, these guys have researched, like, to the extremity of all the different rules that ever existed for all versions of baseball, and put it together into a website. And it's, they're still working on it because it's a lifelong project. But we are featured on Protoball as one of the games in the glossary. If you look up 21st Century Town Ball in Protoball, you'll find us. I reached out to them a few years back. But that website's amazing. It's a good resource for vintage baseball. I mean, really vintage baseball back in the Lincoln days.
Yeah, so I'm looking at your page or your information that's on there, and number 5 is the distance between the stakes, and then it says that this is similar to the formation in the Massachusetts game, but better geometry. So what does that mean?
Sure, I'll be happy to talk about that. So I'm a math teacher, I'm a mathematician, and one of the things I love about baseball is its geometry, right? The field itself. The numerology in the game. I mean, baseball itself is the parabola is everything. But one of the really cool, like almost sacred things about baseball is the number 3, right? Everything in baseball comes down to number 3. There's 3 outs, 3 strikes. You got 90 feet to the bases, which is divisible by, you know, 30 times 3. You got 9 innings, 3 sets of 3. There's 9 players in the field. And it's this perfect, beautiful square, right? It's just like people build baseball fields because it's a beautiful thing.
Sure.
So when we're looking at the Massachusetts game, we're like, okay, we realize this game needs to be fixed. Let's fix it for 2 reasons. Number 1, let's make it playable, because it was playable in high school, like fooling around. It would not be playable as if we're going to make this a national game, which is what our vision is, right? We want to make this a national game. Some of my players are like, no, Mr. Jones, it's international game. I'm like, okay, international game. If we want to make this a national game, you know, we're going to have to make it playable. But also let's consider the fact that baseball is built on perfect geometry. So the way that you run in Massachusetts game, right, after you hit the ball, you run straight to the right. It's like a right angle from the pitcher. And so we're looking at that. We're like, okay, I can see that, and that works well running second and third and fourth, but it doesn't really make a very beautiful figure. It makes a square, but you're kind of running these awkward distances. We're like, okay, how can we make this work so that we're running distances that make sense geometrically, right? That's our thing. Like, how can we make this like baseball?
Right.
So it dawned on us when we were in that class, right? I was with my students. What we would do is after every game, we'd go back to my classroom for lunch, and we would sit there and debate as an entire class. We had because I had a really big following for cricket, so we had like 30 guys, high school guys in there, just like all giving their input, like how the game should be. So we would debate, and we realized if we want to make this work because of the way that you run straight to the right and around, we had to use what people call the golden ratio, right? The Fibonacci sequence. Also known as the golden section, golden rectangle. That whole theme, which I'm confident most of your hearers know, have at least heard of that. If you research the golden section, it turns out the golden section, golden ratio is found out, it's found everywhere in nature, from galaxies, to breeding rates of rabbits, to designs on sunflowers, designs on snails. The golden ratio is just part of God's fingerprint in how he created the entire world. And so we're like, okay, we can borrow from that idea. And so we said, and it works for this game. So we made first base 42 feet away, which is further than the 30 feet for the original Massachusetts game. And then we just kept multiplying by the golden ratio. So we got 42, then 68. 42 plus 68 is 110, right?
Yep.
And if you divide those numbers by 2, you got 21, 34, and 55. Those are all Fibonacci numbers. You might have to look up to see what that is. But the Fibonacci sequence is the mathematical, like, description of what's happening in nature with respect to the golden sector. And the way the Fibonacci sequence works, you take the number one, add it to itself, you get two. Then you add those two numbers, you take one and two, and you get three. Then add two and three, you get five. You add three and five, you get eight. Five and eight, you get 13. So since we were designing the bases based on the Fibonacci sequence, the golden ratio, we said, heck, let's just make the whole game based on the Fibonacci ratio to keep a consistent theme. So everything about 21st Century Town Ball, even though the core of the game is built on the Massachusetts game, is completely based on the Fibonacci sequence. So, for example, we have 13 players per side. 13 is one of the Fibonacci numbers. The batter's box is an 8x5 box. Even the zone is a golden rectangle. It turns out that the zone, the golden rectangle, is actually the exact same size as the Major League Strike Zone. So it really works out. So every part of the game, we just said, let's just use the golden ratio as a common theme. And I can talk more about that. But there's a lot to say at this point, too.
Two things.
Sure.
One, it appears that your addiction to mathematics has driven you to invent a game in which it's all math. Two, you are way too smart for me to be talking to.
I appreciate that. Honestly, it's just been a lot of fun. It's just been with, you know, I teach high school and we have a lot of fun with math and with town ball, and they just kind of blend these two together. We just had so much fun with it. And I've moved here to Oregon. I play with my students here, but also some of the students at George Fox University got wind of what we're doing, and they've been playing town ball now too. And they're just as interested in this as all my students have always been. And it's like, everyone here agrees we got to make this national game, which is why I'm talking to you today. In fact, one of my close friends, he's a student at George Fox. He's in Michigan right now, and he's the one that got me hooked up with you guys because he wants to meet you guys and share the game with you in Michigan. And hopefully I can come out there in July and join you guys too.
Yeah, Michigan is a hotbed of baseball. We got probably around 35 vintage baseball clubs right now. And
great.
And we love to argue about baseball. And what a great segue, Daniel, for the next thing on the list I'm looking at here. That is not like the Massachusetts game. We just had a big blow-up argument in the vintage baseball world about how we use a vintage baseball lineup, which is, and I know I'm not telling you anything you don't know, but in vintage baseball, whoever makes the last out, whoever physically makes the last out of the inning, the next batter in the lineup is the one who leads off the following inning. So if you are forced at, say, third base as the final out of the inning, whoever followed you in the batting order is who leads off next inning. Now I'm looking at the website here, and it says that there's no, you've changed something, and I don't know from what, and that's, I guess, what my question is going to be, but there's no set batting order. It can change each round, and you change that. That's unique to the game. So how was it done in the Massachusetts game, and why did you change it?
Yeah, the Massachusetts game says that they take the batting in turn. So that's definitely not consistent. Our version is not consistent with the Massachusetts game on that one. We play cricket, right? And in cricket, if you play more than one inning, each time you get your team up to bat, you can change the batting order. So, like, you know what? That's a really cool thing. And I have to say, because I know there's going to be people who are like, well, why are you changing so much? The thing is about this game, right? There's only one out, both in the Masters game and in 21st Century Town Ball. There's only one out per inning. It is tough to score, right? Especially if you're running, I think it's 440 feet all the way around in 21st Century Town Ball. We actually have a few rules like that kind of tip the balance in the favor of the batter, batting side. So, for example, if everybody in my team is batted, the next time our team is coming up to bat, you can completely change the batting order. And that's actually necessary because you got 13 players. And also, it allows you to put your big hitters up when you got people on base, which is necessary just to get the game going to score runs.
And that's let me throw this in before you keep going from that. That's actually been something that's been thrown out for today's modern baseball, is when they're looking for something, is when you're losing or tied in the ninth inning, you can start your batting order wherever you want again. You have to use the same.
It's interesting. A lot of the things that we have about 21st century town ball, very recently, Major League Baseball is saying, hey, maybe we should try this. And we're just like, hey, you guys are stealing our idea. So another one of them is the idea of stealing first. That actually came up in a debate last year in Major League Baseball as to whether or not they should allow batters to steal first if there's a pass ball and things. But you think about what's happening, it's because, you know, Major League Baseball is in a crisis, right? That's why we go to Major League Baseball. So, like, there's something not right here. The steroid use, there's over-commercialization. We all want to go back to the baseball that we knew when we were kids, right? And so something's got to change here. And I agree with the vintage baseball movement. Like, I would 100% be on board with vintage baseball if it weren't for 21st century town ball. Because baseball, as it currently is, isn't quite working for the American people. And so I'm kind of in that movement of saying, hey, look, there's another option here. Don't give up on baseball yet. There are other ways to play the game. Come back to the game. Don't leave it. That's kind of my mission, to bring people back to the game.
Right, right. And when you say, you brought up in the past about how there's actually very little action in a modern baseball game. Now, on the flip side, there's also very little action in an NFL game. So probably due to the violence of the NFL is why it's so popular in their short little spans of playing. But it sounds, I'm skeptical about with today, thinking of today's people on the outside looking in on a game that you're not going to score that much. I think the reason why soccer doesn't take off in this country like it does every other country is because of the lack of scoring. We're obsessed with scoring. Would you not agree with that?
We are, but that's not what I'm talking about. I'm not saying, like, let's appeal to the nowadays culture. I'm saying baseball as it is could be a better game. And
oh, no argument. No argument there.
Yeah. I was going to say something else. I can't remember the list. But another thing about our game is that, you know, like when you watch cricket, like the batter can sit there and bunt the ball, right? He doesn't have to run.
Sure.
So we like that idea too. We actually have a rule that says that the batter, if he hits the ball, he doesn't have to run. But if he doesn't run, it's a strike, and he only gets 3 strikes. Does that make sense?
Yes. Third strike, obligated to run.
Third strike to force out. So otherwise, other than that, if you start running the first and it's not forced out, you can go back to the box, like as if it's a base. And another thing about, like, the game being more active, it's not just that it's more active. It's that if you think about what's happening, there's only one out in town ball, right?
Right.
And you can steal first. So what that means, if you think about that, once the pitcher throws the first pitch of the inning, the ball is technically in play at all times until an out is recorded. Because if the pitcher throws a pitch, gets the ball back, looks down to tie his shoe, the batter just took off running at first. The ball's in play. They throw it back to the pitcher, he misses the ball, you know, he's taken off. Or even if you want to steal first, throw the ball back to the pitcher, you can take off. The ball is literally in play at all times. So it's kind of like, it's like a wake-up thing. Like in baseball, if you're not a baseball player like we are, like in baseball, we're always like looking, like Pete Rose, looking for the advantage. How can you advance on the base? Those kinds of things. People who aren't baseball people don't naturally do that. In this game, it kind of wakes you up. It's like, wow, the ball's always in play. You gotta be awake at all times because you got people running. It's like, I think John Thorne, when he was talking about the Massachusetts game, he called it organized chaos. And that's kind of how 21st century town ball is as well. It's amazing. I mean, I'm talking about the game. If some of your listeners just tried the game, or, you know, I'd be happy to fly out, drive out, whatever, teach people how to play. You'll be surprised how legit and how fun this game is.
Now, yes, and with you saying that the ball is always in play, that is something that I think most vintage baseball players are attracted to is that
right.
Concept. But when you're talking only 42 feet to the first stake, you could literally have a pitcher bend over to tie a shoe and the batter could get to that first stake. That's not very far.
No, it's not. And it's a right angle too, so it's a little bit further than for the first in baseball.
Yeah, but taking a base that's 110 feet, that would take.
That's awesome. I mean, there's so much strategy it forces you. This is a chess game you're playing, right? It forces the manager to play chess, right? Because you can change the bet. You know how, like, people love to watch a good manager managing a good game? Like, towards the end of the inning, they got to do, like, you know, pinch hitters and, you know, relief pitchers. That's 21st century town ball the entire game. Because you're constantly having to make a decision. Like, okay, do I put my... There's only one out. You're only allowed one out. You play playing baseball 2 outs constantly. I've got one runner on. We're down by one run. Okay, do I put my big hitter up now and try to score a run or advance the runners? Or do I wait, put another small hitter, get him on? And then, but the thing is, if you do that, you're risking that one out. One pitch down the middle, hits the zone, the inning is over. So it's like, it's all about probability. Constantly trying to optimize probability. It's a phenomenal chess game.
Well, isn't that what drew everybody to baseball and made it the number one sport in this country is the chess game?
Yep.
It is not the overwhelming athleticism. It was
right. The
manager meant something.
Yep.
You know, the managers don't mean anything right now. They don't do anything. They all play by this. Oh, God, I hated Brad Ausmus, the manager of the Tigers, because he did everything the same way all the time. He never went with his gut. It was always,
right. Oh,
you have to do this relief pitcher book. Then. You have to do this, you know. And that's one of the things that kills baseball is the managers don't even matter. So, yes, the chess game aspect is something that needs to come back into baseball. Absolutely. I totally agree with that. And you're talking about how your version, the updated version, what do you call because you obviously can't call it the Massachusetts game. What do you call it? Do you call it you call it 21st century town ball? Is that right?
Yeah. When we're playing, we call it town ball. That's the name of our game. It's there's again a lot of history here that we talked about before our interview. So the word pitch. Most of your listeners probably know this, but you know, back in before the Civil War, every region in this country had their own version of baseball, right? You had Philadelphia town ball, you had round ball in New England, you know, you had baseball in New York. And the thing is, that word baseball, that word round ball, that word town ball, those are interchangeable terms. If someone from the South traveled to the North and they saw them playing baseball, they would turn to their son and say, hey, look, they're playing town ball. It's different, but they're playing town ball. Someone from the North went to the South. He's like, hey, they're playing baseball. It's a little different, but it's baseball. So those terms were regional terms. It just so happens the game that won out as our national pastime happened to be called baseball. So when you say town ball, you know, you probably know this, but in Minnesota in the 1970s, right, they were playing baseball, but they called it town ball, right? That's just what the regional term was, and that term just kind of stuck in that area. Now they call it baseball, but in the 70s, like, they called it town ball, especially the amateur games of town ball. And so somehow the Massachusetts game got dubbed town ball retroactively. So after the New York game became the official American pastime, and this is now baseball, we're going to call this game, this is baseball. They said, oh, this is a different game in Massachusetts they played? Let's just call that one town ball, even though it was never called town ball at the time, right? That's what they called it baseball. Massachusetts game of baseball is what the game was called. And so the website, when we first learned about the Massachusetts game, called our version of baseball town ball, and it just stuck right away. It was like, hey, we're playing a different game. We're playing town ball. So we dubbed our own game town ball, which works because technically what we're playing is a version of town ball. Any bat and ball game is a version of town ball. It's also a version of baseball. So we're thinking, since the term baseball has already been taken, we're going to take the term town ball, since there's no modern game called town ball. So this is 21st century town ball is what we're playing.
How often do you get people giving you a hard time about changing things up and starting something like this?
You know, the only time I've encountered that is when I'm talking to vintage baseball people, and you know, they're right. They really know their history. They know what they're talking about. But the thing is, they get stuck in this mind frame. Pardon me if I'm offending any of your listeners, but it's like, okay, you got to get the terminology right. Massachusetts game isn't town ball, so don't call it town ball. Well, technically, it is a version of the Townball. Again, like I'm saying, because those terms were interchangeable. So, I mean, I think we have a case that calling it Townball is just fine. Especially since I have over 100 people that call it Townball over on the West Coast.
Well, I don't think the vintage baseball community has overall this complaining about everything aspect. I think there's just some people that know more than anybody else that try to keep us in line, and sometimes that spills over. And I thought this might be one of those things that spills over into.
And that's totally fine. I enjoy those conversations. So
absolutely. I'm really glad that we had this interview, and we're not done because we're going to talk Minnesota Twins. But this has taught me a lot, not only about the past, the Massachusetts game, because I always do some research when, you know, I'm going to interview somebody, because I don't want to sound like a babbling fool throughout the whole thing anyway. And so I've learned a lot, and I've seen a lot of stuff, gone to a lot of websites about what you're doing here. I think we've been in contact with each other as far as you possibly coming out in, I think it was July, to do something with this. And I tell you that the regular baseball club of Mount Clemens, who I have a match scheduled with at this point, is the perfect combination of historic accuracy, fine gentlemen that are always looking. They would not have a problem trying something new and historic like this.
Hope so, yeah.
So I more than welcome you out to Michigan. I will definitely help you put on an event to get people to come check this out. And the only thing that you have to agree to do in return is to play in a vintage baseball match.
It'll be my first, and it will be my honor. I'm actually not, like I said, I grew up overseas, and you know, I still kind of feel like I'm still, you know, even though I'm American, United States citizen, born here, parents, American generation, I'm still trying to, like, get myself to fully believe I'm part of this culture. I would love to play a vintage baseball game.
So we'll keep in contact, and we'll try to make that happen. And this has been a great talk, and I thank you for bringing this to everybody. And I hope it's as entertaining and as curious to everybody that listens to the show as it is to me right now, because I'm not done with this. I'm not going to file this away when I'm done recording and just never. I want to look into this. This is a game where the ball is never dead. It's something that we do talk about. Because some of the rules that we change around here for our benefits that aren't historically accurate take away that aspect of the ball being alive. And it certainly would lead to more excitement if the ball was never dead, and no matter what game you're playing, really. So,
yeah.
Okay, Daniel, you mentioned earlier that you're a Minnesota Twins fan. Is that still the case?
It is. I have to admit, I haven't been following it. but, yes, I grew up Minnesota Twins fan. I still consider myself a Twins fan, for sure.
And now you're in Oregon, so you don't get to see any professional baseball, but you probably have some minor league baseball in the area. Is that right?
You know, I don't think we do. I don't even know.
You've only been there 2 years, right?
I've been here 2 years. Kind of had my head down just with a lot of projects I'm working on, Townball being one of them. I'm also a mathematician, and I have 7 kids, but I play with them as much as I can. And growing up, Twins all the way.
Now, 7 kids, are you trying to get up to 9 to make it divisible by 3 because of your math addiction?
No, 7's still a nice number. I'm 67, I think.
okay, so back when the Twins have been good on more than one occasion, because the Twins were actually thought of as the organization that did things the right way. So, right. But back in the late 80s and the early 90s, when they won a World Series, my Twins trivia is not, you know, at the most, I'm a Tigers fan and I hate the Twins. But so your main fandom is back. You're talking Kirby Puckett and Kent Herbeck and Dan Gladden. And is that right? Is exactly. that the era?
Dan Gladden, Frank Viola, Burt Blevin. Yeah, that's the truth.
And the Hillsbury Hops are a Major League Baseball team in Hillsboro, Oregon. How far away are you from Hillsboro?
From where? Hillsboro?
Hillsboro.
We are not too far from Hillsboro.
Well, there you go. There's your baseball team.
Okay. There you go.
The Hillsboro Hops.
Okay.
Yeah, they were founded after 2013 after the Yakima Bears moved to Hillsboro in 2012. Okay, so they're a Class A Northwest League. They're a farm team of the Arizona Diamondbacks. And they're named after hops, which, of course, is just important when it comes to beer. And their logo is of a hop. You have to get on board with this, Daniel. Okay, so the Twins, what was that? There was a player on the Twins I would always mix up with a former AWA professional wrestler because I watched that when I was a kid back in
Kent Herbeck.
No, it was Gagne. Was it? There's like a Greg Gagne.
Greg Gagne.
Yes. Okay. So Greg Gagne was on the Twins, and there was a wrestler Greg Gagne that was Vern Gagne's son, and he was a professional wrestler. So I'd always get that mixed up, just like I just did. So did you?
Yeah, you might be thinking about Kent Herbeck, the first baseman.
Kent Herbeck, he was a big guy.
He was
missing a vowel, and I hear a lot of stories about Kent Herbeck. How do you become a Twins fan, being in California, Taiwan? Where did Minnesota come into this?
So my mom is a third generation like farmer's daughter. So, you know, think all the Iowa, Minnesota crops, soybean, corn. So she, you know, she met my dad in college, and he was studying to be a preacher. So when I was 5 years old, they moved to Taiwan. So my mom's side, they were into the Twins back with Rod Carew and Harmon Killebrew, Bobby Allison, that group. And then my mom would tell me stories about, you know, them growing up on the farm, playing ball, and pretending to be those players. And so we did the same thing in the 80s. I got an interesting story, though, because Brian Harper, one of the players for the 91 team, he actually went to Taiwan, and we had the privilege of picking him up at the airport in Taiwan. He ran a baseball camp there. I don't know how it happened that we were picking him up, but so he was telling me about the Twins and stuff, but it's just so bizarre. Some of the things when you grow up overseas, some of the things that you see and experience are just so drastically different. Like, why did we pick up Brian Harper?
Yeah, that's kind of random. That's very random.
Yeah.
Who were some of the players over in Taiwan that you do you remember any other names that were that were really good over there in Taiwan that you liked watching?
Yeah, I don't know that I at the time knew of any, but I know there were some that became more famous after they moved back to the States. But I can't think of any that I knew when I was young. I do know that the big players would come to Taiwan and play sometimes, and they would, you know, the Taiwanese would try to beat them.
You know, being a player that plays in the United States and then goes over and plays in Taiwan, you're playing the same game, but boy, it's got to have a different feel to it. Once again, I'm referring to the crowd interaction.
Yep.
One of the things I've always have on my bucket list is to go to Japan and go to a baseball game, because wow, that just always is so crazy. Something you should know about the Hillsboro Hops is they're the defending league champions, Daniel. So you're coming in a winner. I just, it's time to get on the Hillsboro Hops bandwagon. They've won the championship three times over the last 7 years. So
okay.
I'm trying. I don't get any commission off of your fandom. I was actually looking up to see if they've had any players move on to the majors. We have a minor league baseball team here close to where I'm at. It's in Midland, Michigan. It's called the Great Lakes Loons. It's a single A developmental league, and it's where Clayton Kershaw and D. Gordon got their starts. So we got that going for us. But I enjoy the minor league baseball because they try harder. So
yeah.
And there's actually more, as we talked about earlier with the chess game, the managers are forced in minor league baseball to get involved in the chess games a little bit more because they're trying to get better jobs. And
yeah,
and they think the better chess they play is how they get to better jobs. But then they get to the majors, right, and they have to stop playing chess. That doesn't make sense to me. So, yeah. Daniel, hey, thanks for coming on here, putting up with my tomfoolery. The Minnesota Twins, Kent Herbeck. Did you have something you wanted to add about Kent Herbeck?
No, other than he and Dan Gladden are fair players.
I think Dan Gladden went on and played like a season with the Detroit Tigers after his run with the Twins.
Oh, did he? I knew he was on he actually went to Fresno State and then played for the Giants and the Twins, and I kind of lost track of them.
Well, yeah. So thanks for coming on. I hope everybody enjoys this episode as much as I did, and I hope they do not just shun the idea of what you're doing and really look at how you got a lot of – I'm going to draw this out a little bit more. You did this with your students. You're getting young people active and exercising and stuff with this, are you not?
Not only that, but, I mean, my players, I mean, some of them, most of them are not baseball players, but the ones that are, after they try town ball, they're like, I'm not going back to baseball. They like the game as much. And a lot of the players are like cricket players, you know, soccer players, tennis players, and they're considered town ball, like, up there with their favorite sport. So it's like, seems to appeal to a very wide range of audience, and students, yeah, young people love it. They're not so worried about the vintage aspect of it. They just like to play it. But I do want to say, I do plan to come out to Michigan in July, and I know Grant, he actually is there right now. He would love to reach out to you and just talk a bit, maybe even meet you. But if anyone's listening and is just faintly interested in 21st Century Town Ball, I would be happy, really excited to be talking to you. Our email address is on our website. Just go ahead and just reach out to me, and we'll see if we can get together and play some Town Ball.
Absolutely. Are you on any social media platforms?
We are. We're on Facebook and Instagram.
Okay. I tried to look you up individually on Facebook, and I don't think you are on Facebook, but do you know how hard it is to look up Daniel Jones on Facebook? That's just, that's a nightmare. I was getting more New York Giants than I was you.
Yep.
Okay, Daniel. Thanks. Thanks again for being on the show.
Matthew, I appreciate it.
Make sure you stay on the line here. And to the rest, sure, to everybody listening, I want to say thanks for listening to another episode. Downloads are up. The show is growing on a weekly basis, much like the coronavirus, but that's that's not good. And so you can catch Roller Out the Barrel on, I have a Facebook page, I have an Instagram page, I have a website, www.strikewelljents.org. And let me know if there's something you want to hear about, somebody you want me to talk to, and we'll see what we can do with that. And until that, we'll see you next episode.
Post game show is brought to you by Christ, I can't find it. The hell with it.